Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, it's so lovely to be here at the Tattered Cover, and I thought that the last time I'd been, I think the last time I was here was 4 years ago when my novel Intuition was published, which is over there. And it's amazing to be back in the summertime, especially because I came from Boston and it's incredibly hot there right now. It's about 100 degrees and the humidity is unbelievable. So like just coming off the plane here and feeling the dry air is so nice. Everybody came off of our plane and we were just like, this feels so good. This is so civilized. This is what summer should be like. So it is wonderful to be here. Now, my novel Intuition started off in Cambridge. It's set in Cambridge, and it's about a group of cancer researchers who work in a lab near MIT. And I myself live in Cambridge. At the time that I wrote Intuition, I lived in a house that was halfway between MIT and Harvard. And my house and my neighborhood were really surrounded by laboratories, not just MIT and Harvard, but independent laboratories as well. We have, you name it, we have cancer institutes, we have independent laboratories, we have the Broad Institute, the Whitehead Institute. It just goes on and on. And I got interested actually in writing about scientists partly because I lived in the neighborhood of so many scientists. In fact, just down the street from my old house is the U.S. headquarters of the drug giant Novartis. They took over a large factory in East Cambridge, and they have this huge facility there. So when it came time to write my next novel and work on my next project, I also started from where I lived. I started from Cambridge, and I was interested in some of the other sorts of companies that were sprouting up in Cambridge, especially during the end of the last century. And those were many of those internet startups during the dot-com boom. And a lot of those startup companies were spawned from research at MIT. And some of them, actually many of them, are still there even now, 10 years later, which is hard to believe. So I had this interest as I was watching these companies come up in the warehouses and old factories of East Cambridge near my old house, in writing about that crazy period of the dot-com boom. And so I began this project of writing a historical novel. I wrote a historical novel about the very recent past. I wrote a historical novel about 10 years ago. It really does feel like ancient history, considering that all that has happened economically, socially, politically, in so many ways. And that was part of the fun of it, you know, writing about ancient history that we've all lived through. At the same time as I was beginning this project, writing a novel set during the dot-com era, I had another idea for a novel. And that idea began with an observation that was, you know, less historical and economic, but more personal, which is that I'm one of those people who loves nothing more than curling up in bed with a good cookbook and reading it. And also, even a good cookbook, cook magazine, Food and Wine, a magazine like that, Gourmet, which is now gone, with those beautiful, beautiful photographs of the food. I love all that stuff. I don't actually cook myself, but I love reading cookbooks. And I've noticed this about other people as well, that many people who don't cook love to read cookbooks, and many people who don't cook elaborate dishes love to read elaborate recipes that they themselves would never have the time or energy to make and track down all the ingredients. But, you know, it's interesting. So this observation I sort of took with me, and I wanted to write a novel about somebody who read cookbooks but didn't cook. Now, both of these ideas developed as time went on. My idea of writing a novel set in the dot-com era began to develop as I started thinking about companies that I could invent for myself. I had invented a cancer research center in my last book, so, you know, why not go from there and develop my own internet startups in this book. And also this parallel idea of writing about people who read cookbooks but don't actually cook. And I began to think about writing a novel about hunger of different kinds. Hunger for money, hunger for fame, hunger for knowledge, hunger for food, and the things that we do instead of satisfying or working to satisfy those cravings, to defer those desires, or even to displace them. So that instead of cooking, we read about cooking. Instead of connecting with people directly, we live in a virtual world, you know, at our computer screens, and defer. Instead of building a family, we build a collection, as one of the characters in my book does. And so those themes began to develop in my mind, and I decided to take these twin themes and write a novel about two sisters, one named Emily, who is the CEO of an internet startup in Silicon Valley, and her younger sister, Jess, who is a philosophy graduate student and works for an antiquarian bookseller. So as you can see, in my labyrinthine imagination, these ideas began to come together, and this book is the result. And you know, you've probably heard the old adage for writers that you should write about what you know. And I've always been a proponent of that. I think that you should write what you know. But I modify that as well, and I would say begin with what you know. So I began with what I knew, and I began to do research from there and extrapolate and imagine, so that my book became not just about people who read cookbooks, but about people who collect cookbooks. Not just ordinary cookbooks, but rare cookbooks. Again, living in Cambridge, which is a very unusual place, I took advantage of my local neighborhood. In Cambridge, at the Radcliffe Institute, which is part of Harvard, is one of the finest cookbook collections in the world. It's open to the public. And I began to research really rare early printed cookbooks in the 17th century and 16th century in different languages, and followed that there. I also did some research by going back to the Bay Area, where I had gone to graduate school, and did location scouting for my characters who lived out in Berkeley for that part of my book. And all of these things wove together. And so this is a book of many strands. I'm going to read to you from a part near the beginning of the book, which will introduce you to one of the sisters in this book. This is just from one of the strands in my book. But this is a scene with Jess, the younger sister, and it deals with her experience working for the antiquarian bookseller in Berkeley. And I thought it would be kind of fun to read this in a bookstore surrounded by books. I will read you from this, and then I would love to answer any questions that you might have about writing this book, or, you know, not writing this book, getting stuck writing this book, and all of those fun things. Yorick's Used and Rare Books had a small storefront on Channing, but a deep interior shaded by tall bookcases crammed with history, poetry, theology, antiquated anthologies. There was no open wall space to hang the framed prints for sale, so Hogarth's scenes of lust, pride, and debauchery leaned rakishly against piles of novels, folktales, and literary theory. In the back room, these piles were so tall and dusty that they took on a geological air, rising like stalagmites. Jess often felt her workplace was a secret mine or quarry, where she could pry crystals from crevices and sweep precious jewels straight off the floor. As she tended crowded shelves, she opened one volume and then another, turning pages on the history of gardens, perusing Edna St. Vincent Millay. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry, and you ate an apple, and I ate a pear from a dozen of each we had bought somewhere. Dipping into Gibbon, the decline of Rome was the natural and inevitable effect of immoderate greatness. Prosperity ripened the principle of decay. And old translations of Grimm's fairy tales. They walked the whole day over meadows, fields, and stony places, and when it rained, the little sister said, "Heaven and our hearts are weeping together." During her first days at Yorick's, the bell had startled Jess when a customer arrived, and she'd been reluctant to stop reading. Then the shop owner, George Friedman, had reminded Jess that he paid her to help others, not simply to help himself herself to books. He didn't have to tell Jess twice. Now she engaged every customer she had the pleasure to meet. She greeted and advised, volunteering the opinions literary, philosophical, or poetic. George rued the day. Jess had a look about her, an unsettling blend of innocence and pedantry. She fixed her gray-green eyes upon the customers and said, "You like Henry James? Really?" As if she couldn't quite believe it. Or she'd warn the purchaser of a multi-volume history of domestic life in Victorian England, "You know, this is a history of women's work based almost exclusively on male sources." "It's a free country," George called out from the back room, or sometimes sotto voce behind the counter. "Just ring up the damn books." She came in 3 afternoons a week, and while he'd hoped those would be times he could absent himself, George didn't like leaving Jess alone to chase away the odd shopper who came in off the street. True, York's was more of a project than a business, but he planned to break even one of these years. Jess had to be watched. She was well-read, opinionated, unconcerned with profit. Also, George liked watching her. He was old money, a Microsoft millionaire, now returned to Berkeley, where he'd gone to college in the 70s, majoring in physics with a minor in psychotropics. He had worked in the Excel group when a long-haired physicist was not so uncommon, and Bill Gates still lived in a conventionally pretty house with a computer on the kitchen counter. Microsoft had been feisty in George's day, competing for market share. By the time he left, the place was expanding geometrically so that construction crews and moving trucks and summer interns swarmed the Redmond campus. Pod-like buildings multiplied around the shallow pool known as Lake Bill. Theme cafeterias sprang up with different cuisines in each. The company picnic began to look like a county fair, except that the band playing was Chicago, flown in for the occasion. As share prices soared, George's friends had bought cars. They began with sports cars, and then they bought vintage cars, and finally they bought kits and built custom cars from scratch. Then George's friends bought houses on Lake Washington. They bought small houses and then bigger houses, and then they renovated those houses and commissioned furniture, sculptural dining tables and beds and rocking chairs in bird's eye maple. They collected glass and bought chihulis by the dozen. They retired and purchased boats and traveled, and some started little companies and foundations of their own, and others flew to cooking classes in Tuscany and hosted fundraisers for Bill Clinton. Along the way, they married and divorced, raised children, and came out, not necessarily in that order. Like his retired friends, George traveled and donated to worthy causes, but he was eccentric as well, a reader, an autodidact with such a love for great books that he scarcely passed anymore for a Berkeley liberal. An 18th century liberal, perhaps. Strange to say, but at this time in his life, George would have had a happier conversation with Berkeley the philosopher than with most of his old Berkeley friends. He bought a Maybeck house in the hills and looked down upon the city he'd once loved. Previously anti-war, at 39, his new concern was privacy. He grew suspicious, his friend said paranoid, of technology, and refused to use email or cell phones. He feared government control of information and identity, and loathed decolonizing forces of big business as well. He became a benefactor of the Free Software Foundation, boycotted the very products with which he'd made his fortune, and called Microsoft the evil empire, although he still owned stock. In the eye of the internet storm, George sought the treasures of the pre-digital age. He wanted pages he could turn and records he could spin. Eschewing virtual reality, he collected old typewriters and dictionaries and hand-drawn maps. He began acquiring rare books and opened Yorick's. The store was not always the kind of adventure George wanted. Good help proved elusive. Graduate students, budding novelists, future screenwriters, manic depressive book thieves, he'd seen them all. With a kind of gallows humor, he had printed up a questionnaire that he distributed to those seeking employment. When Jess had turned up inquiring about a part-time job, he showed her the dark, crammed store, the thicket of history, philosophy, and literary criticism in the center, fiction all along the walls and trailing into the back room, where random stacks cluttered the floor. Then he returned to his desk and handed her his printed list of questions. "Could I borrow a pen?" Jess asked, after digging in her backpack and turning up a handful of change in a warped chocolate bar. She was young. She had the clear-eyed beauty of a girl who still believed that, as they used to say, she could be anything she wanted to be. Of course, she would not consider herself a girl. The word was offensive, but she had a girl's body, delicate shoulders and fine arms, and like a girl, she had no idea how fresh she looked. George handed Jess a black ballpoint, and she took the questionnaire and filled it out right on the other side of his desk. He tried not to stare, even though she was leaning. Casting his eyes down, he resisted the impulse to turn up the sleeve covering her writing hand. When Jess finished, she returned the questionnaire and waited, expecting George to read her answers right away. He ignored her. When she hovered, he said, "Give me a couple of days and I'll call you." But he read the completed questionnaire as soon as she left. 1. Full name. Jessamine Elizabeth Bach. 2. Are you a convicted felon? No. 3. Are you an unconvicted felon? Not to my knowledge. 4. Are you currently taking or dealing illegal drugs? No. 5. Are you sure? Pretty sure. 6. Circle 1. A bookstore is a meeting place, a mating place, a research room, a library, or a store, as the name suggests. Store for convicted felons? 7. Circle 1. It's acceptable to wear earphones or use cell phones or notebook computers at work. Rarely. Sometimes. If I am day trading. Never. Oh, none of the above. 8. Circle 1. It's acceptable to take money from the register. Rarely. Sometimes. If I really need to pay my dealer. Never. Wow, sounds like you've been burned. Sorry. 9. Short answer. No more than 3 sentences, please. Why do you want to work here? I want to work here because I really need the money for day trading. Just kidding. I love books and I'm well qualified to talk about them if you need someone knowledgeable. You have a great philosophy section, and as I mentioned, I am a grad student in philosophy. 10. Why, in your opinion, is this store named Yorick's? I think this is a trick question. You want us to say because of alas, poor Yorick in Hamlet, but I can tell from looking at you that you are one of those guys who reads Tristram Shandy over and over again. So I'm guessing you named the store after Parson Yorick in the novel. George read this last answer twice. The phrase, one of those guys, chafed. Was she saying he was simply an esoteric type? He fancied himself original, and he was miffed, or thought maybe he should be, for although he had a sense of humor, he exercised it primarily at others' expense. He found Jess a little flip, but she seemed sane, an unlikely arsonist. She'd do. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.